the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to the What Monero Did podcast. Yes, this week I have none other than Ricardo Spagni, aka Fluffy Pony, aka Mr. Monero, on the show. Someone who I've been trying to get on the podcast for ages. But before I talk about that, I do have a message from my show sponsor. And as I said before, please do listen. Don't just skip this. Check them out, as these advertisers pay for me to keep the show going. So let's talk about BlockFi, who offer crypto-backed loans. If you're holding on to crypto, you can put your Bitcoin and Ether to work without even selling it. BlockFi gives cryptocurrency owners access to cash through lowest cost cryptocurrency to dollar borrowing. BlockFi have also created a special offer to my listeners. So if you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you will get $25 in free crypto added to your collateral balance for loans under $10,000, or $50 in crypto for loans over $10,000, and applying only takes less than 2 minutes. BlockFi is spelled B-L-O-C-K-F-I. Also, next up, look, this isn't an advert, this isn't paid for, but I did want to recommend the Dire newsletter, as I've been subscribed for ages and the content they're producing is pretty amazing. You may have seen this week a tweet from Larry with a whole bunch of research data they released on ICO treasuries. Well, they are consistently producing great content like this, so I just wanted to give them a shout out. You can subscribe to that over at dire.co, that is D-I-A-R.co, and you can support the great work they are doing. Okay, on to the show, on to Fluffy. I can't tell you how excited I was to record this. I've been trying to schedule something with him for months. We've passed each other at a couple of cities. We missed each other in San Francisco recently. We met it briefly at Consensus, but finally we got our diaries aligned. And despite some initial issues with internet connectivity and sound recording, we finally got to record a show together, and I think it's an excellent one. And I've also always found Monero interesting. It's one of the first cryptocurrencies I ever bought. And as I've ventured further down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, the one altcoin I've never sold is Monero. I've sold Bitcoin a few times, but never my XMR. And initially, it was because I really didn't know how to use the command line tool. But I've just liked the project. I like the team. I like Ricardo. I think privacy is important. So I have never sold my Monero. And you know what the funny thing is that I found with Monero? I've noticed there's two types of Bitcoin maximus. There are those that are Bitcoin only. Everything else is a shitcoin. Don't buy it. Jog on. No interest in you. But there are also a bunch of Bitcoin maximalists who are like, yeah, I'm a Bitcoin maximalist. Everything else is shitcoin. But yeah, Monero is pretty cool. And I get it. I think ideologically they share some similarities. But also I think because Bitcoin is not entirely anonymous, there is an acceptable use case and argument that Monero does have a role to play in this cryptocurrency market. So I talk about this with Ricardo. We talk about why Monero has managed to earn the respect of some maximalists. We also get into why privacy is important to him, but also to others, and you know, why people ignore it. We talk about the potential for a privacy web stack and the future of Monero, and also his project Tari, which he co-founded with Naveen. Also, please do support the show. I've got a couple of updates here, so bear with me. So firstly, I've started a Patreon page. The podcast is increasingly taking up more and more of my time. I've said before, it usually takes me about a day or two to prepare for a show, and I would like to go up to twice weekly. Also, realistically, I am retiring as a trader. I'm crap at it anyway, but I want to focus on producing more content. So I've opened up a Patreon page. There's a few options. There's a very basic $2 option, which gets you access to my Patreon feed. If you pay $5, you'll get an early version of the show each week. That will have all adverts taken out. And there is also a $25 What Bitcoin Did maximalist option. So with this one, if you don't have time to produce a podcast, you don't know how, but you want to get involved in this, if you join this tier, you'll be able to get early access to who I'm going to interview, and you can help me prepare the interview framework, and I will credit you in the show notes. There are also a couple of advertising options. If people want to advertise on the show, please do go and check that out. So yes, if you want to help support the show, you can become a patron. So do this by heading over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid, and I will share that on the show notes. And yeah, I've already got my first three, which is pretty cool. Also, please leave me a review on iTunes. I ask this every week, but it does support the show, and it supports all podcasters. So any other podcast you listen to, you should be doing that for them as well, leaving them a 5-star review. Please follow me on social media. I am on Twitter, Medium, Instagram, everywhere I'm listed as What Bitcoin Did. And if you reach out to me, I'll probably reply to you. And also, please do check out my website. I've made some changes recently. I've got a new homepage, which has got a complete archive of all the shows. And I'm gradually removing all old nonsense content, which doesn't make sense anymore. Stuff I wrote ages ago, which I don't agree with. And also, I've added a resources page listing all the podcasts I can find in the crypto and Bitcoin, Medium people worth following, newsletters, and other crypto things. So if you head over to my website and head over to the resources section, you'll see that. I think I found something like 50 crypto podcasts, which is pretty amazing, really. So please do go and support some of these other shows. I know how much work goes involved, and everyone creating this content is working their butts off to help crypto. So yeah, go and check that out and support some of the other shows. And then also tomorrow, inspired by Nathaniel Whitmore, someone who I talk to on Twitter quite a bit, he has something called Long Read Sunday, where he gathers up all the interesting content from crypto over the week, all the tweets, and puts them together. And actually, I think he's now turned it into a newsletter, which I think you should subscribe to, and I'll share a link to that out in the show notes. But I'm going to do a weekly summary starting from tomorrow of all the great podcasts, all the great episodes that have come out this week, the ones that I've listened to that I think are worth checking out. So yes, check that out. That's on my Twitter tomorrow. And also go and follow Nathaniel. His Twitter handle is at NLW. Yep, that show off has a 3-character Twitter handle. But go and check him out. He produces so much interesting content. And then lastly, please do share this show out with your friends and family. Every time I see you share it out, I see it and it's really helpful to me. So firstly, I appreciate it. And those who haven't done it, if you don't mind, that would be great. Okay, that's a lot of updates this week. I'm sorry. Sorry for rabbiting on. So let's move on to the interview. I hope you enjoy it. If you do have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. My email is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And yes, I pretty much reply to everyone. So yeah, feel free to email me. Good morning, Ricardo. How are you?
Good, thanks. And you?
Good, thank you. Finally got to do this. We met briefly at Consensus. I've been trying to get to you for some time. I did want to come to South Africa because I wanted you to teach me about South African red wine. Usually you've got a big stack behind you. But I'm not going to go into the origin story. I watched your interview with Ivan on tech. That's all been covered, so I'll share that. But I think a good point for me to start with, having followed you for some time, is why Monero?
Good question. I think at the beginning, one of the things that attracted me very much to Monero was the fact that it wasn't based on Bitcoin's code. That alone was reason enough for me to give it a second look. Simply cloning Bitcoin or forking Bitcoin generally leads to things that are not terribly interesting. You're taking a foundation that is solid, that has nearly a decade of proven history, and you're fudging around with the incentives, or you're slapping some lipstick on a pig, or you're adding functionality that disincentivizes or that creates certain disincentives. And that to me is not very interesting. So it started off with like, oh, look, he has some novel cryptography. He has a code base, which admittedly was not a very mature code base or even a very glamorous one, but at least it was new. And then, of course, the privacy aspect was very appealing as well. The fact that it was finally doing something concrete and solid for privacy. It might not have been doing so in the most scalable way. There's certain aspects of Monero's privacy that are weaker than I would like them to be. But just in general, being privacy focused and being something that pushed the privacy barrier forward, I think was very important. Very important to me, at least.
And one of the things I've noticed as somebody who's regarded as someone newer to the space is there's 3 camps of people. We seem to have Bitcoin maximalists, then Bitcoin maximalists, but Monero's cool, and then everyone else. Why do you do you understand my observation?
Yeah, it's totally true.
I found like meeting and interviewing people that if there's certain people I've mentioned any coin, a shit coin, that you kind of laughed out the building. But if you mention Monero, you're okay. Why do you think Monero has been saved from the hatred of the maximalists?
I think there are a couple of things. The fact that that the founder has disappeared is one aspect. So there's very little self-enrichment. Everyone that got involved with Monero early on had to deal with pretty much what Bitcoin has had to deal with early on. When I first started using Bitcoin, the experience was certainly not smooth. The wallet looked like it was something out of Windows 95. And, you know, there were very few wallet choices. Everything was just very, very clunky. You know, running a node chewed way more bandwidth than running a node today does, even though there's significantly more use. And that's just because of improvements in block propagation. So I think when, you know, when people who got involved with Monero early on had to deal with only a command line wallet, the entire database in RAM, so it chewed up like 4, 5, 6 gigs of RAM for the first 6 months. All of the stuff, all of the clunkiness and the ugliness and the, you know, CPU mining and all of the nasty stuff that we had to deal with at the beginning, Bitcoin is fine familiar, or at least Bitcoin maximalists find familiar, because they understand that that's the stuff Bitcoiners had to go through at the beginning. We didn't get anything handed to us on a platter. We didn't get a slick mobile wallet that someone else had written that we could fork and change the name and change the logo and go, hey, look, we made a Monero mobile wallet. Everything had to be done from scratch. Every integration had to, like, if an exchange wanted to add it, then they would be like, oh, but it's not a Bitcoin fork. Yeah, we don't know if we can add it. And then it was like, okay, well, what if we helped you? What if we, you know, here's the guides that we've written to cold storage, and here's how to integrate Monero, and, you know, oh, but the RPC calls are different, and you don't have block notify and wallet notify. And there's like all the stuff that we just didn't have that people were used to in 2014 already, you know, from an integration perspective. And we had to sit and like and baby people through and baby ourselves through, because it's a code base we weren't familiar with, and write the stuff from scratch. And I think that garnishes a lot of respect in and of itself. In fact, it's the same reason why I have a smattering of respect for the people that have done the same thing on like Ethereum. They've had to also write stuff from scratch. I have very strong opinions about Ethereum beyond that, but I just think that this process of going and writing something from scratch and having to you know, do so in a way that is extremely difficult as an open source project, where you're underfunded, under-resourced, and you're reliant on people pitching up and volunteering their help. That is, it's a challenge that very few coins survive if they go down that road. But if they do, and if they have a value proposition that actually makes sense, then they will absolutely garner respect.
But I think that is very true. But also the value proposition is another main point, because if Litecoin had gone through the same difficulties of starting up and an original code base, and nobody had known it was Charlie Lee, I still don't think it would have the same respect as Monero. And as Bitcoin proved not to be anonymous, there is a significant and obvious use case for Monero.
That's true. I think at the same time, I mean, I think that we're moving towards an interesting point of inflection in Bitcoin's history, where real privacy has a shot at coming to Bitcoin on chain. You know, there's only so much you can do off chain, and I'm kind of hopeful that will drive the conversation forward, and it will make Monero less ostracized. But I think that there are. I mean, it appears to me that there are two types of Bitcoin maximalists, which you pointed out earlier. Those that go, Monero is pointless because Bitcoin's going to get privacy anyway. And those that go, Monero serves a purpose right now, even if it doesn't serve that purpose forever. And I guess, the one thing that I'm not convinced of is I'm not convinced that adding strong privacy to Bitcoin is going to be an easy road.
Right.
I think it's going to be very, very challenging. And I'm interested to see how things progress.
And when you say ostracized, do you mean that because Monero is a privacy coin, the chances of Monero appearing as a Coinbase listing is almost zero to none because of the KYC AML problems? But if Bitcoin brings in privacy, there's going to be a decision whether places like Coinbase suddenly delist it or whether privacy now becomes something that's allowed.
Exactly. So, you know, I'm really, really hopeful that that it'll be the latter, that people will go like, okay, you know what, privacy is actually cool. And I'm hoping that some of the efforts that we're making with Monero, some of the conversations we're having with people along the way, You know, the Monero community members that speak at meetups, that bump into regulators, that bump into people that work at exchanges, that continue to have these conversations about privacy not being criminal. I'm hoping that that also helps, again, move that conversation forward so that when Bitcoin adds or when Bitcoin starts to add privacy enhancements, that it's less controversial and more, hey, look, Monero's already accepted and so it won't be a bad thing.
Yeah, I agree. I can't imagine a conversation at the SEC where people are saying privacy is cool.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I actually have a suspicion that politicians are among the first to value privacy for themselves. I just don't know if they value privacy for their constituents. You know, they're sort of like, well, I need privacy for all the fundraising that I do. I need people to be able to donate to my political campaign privately. But, you know, that guy over there, you know, he might be a criminal, so he shouldn't have privacy. It's bizarre.
It's more for the government agencies, right?
There's that too. You know, like I said to someone the other day, I watched the new Jack Ryan series and TV series, and I was thinking to myself, like, how does the CIA move money overseas? You know, I mean, I'm sure they've got it down to a fine art by now, and I could certainly think of many ways, including cash. But I mean, surely stuff like Monero must be a tool that they look at and they're like, hey, this can be a thing we can use.
Well, yeah, but they have the ability to be hypocrites.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I think that's what I was, you know, alluding to earlier as well. It's like privacy is important for me, the politician, but not for the people that I'm supposed to be serving.
And interestingly, with Monero, as much as something like Lightning would be cool on Monero, it's not something I see as a necessity like maybe with Bitcoin. So if on-chain scaling wasn't a problem, Bitcoin bringing privacy to the code base would be a bit of a threat to Monero in that there wouldn't be totally distinguishable features. But I imagine the fact that total privacy across Bitcoin's base chain and Lightning is going to be very difficult, which maintains a distinct use case for Monero.
Yeah, so Lightning is interesting because Monero actually, Lightning by itself adds some interesting privacy properties. You know, the fact that your transaction isn't on a ledger, and the fact that for somebody to actually figure out that a transaction happened means they have to monitor the entire Lightning network passively, which is significantly difficult, means that there's already great privacy properties in Lightning. But there's certain things that can happen which break down Lightning's privacy properties. So as an example, when you're done with a whole bunch of payments and you close a channel and then the recipient closes a channel, then they can see, an observer can look at the ledger and be like, well, Bob's balance went down by half a Bitcoin and Starbucks' balance went up by half a Bitcoin. So Bob's obviously, you know, bought a bunch of coffees at Starbucks over years. And that inference is not great from a privacy perspective. So having stuff like confidential transactions on Monero's base layer is really helpful because it means that if we, you know, plug Lightning in on top of Monero, we are adding incredible amounts of privacy to Lightning. And if you take Monero as a base layer with Tumblebits as a Lightning router, then it becomes incredibly powerful. You have this, like, that to me is the maximal amount of privacy that we can get today. It is significantly stronger privacy than Monero's base layer. And even when things break down and devolve back down to Monero's base layer for settlement, then that settlement is still super private. And I'm hoping that that's where we're going to end up, is even if it's not that exact thing, that we'll have options like that, options like a Mimblewimble sidechain, all these things that just give us additional privacy, but when the privacy settles back to Monero's base layer, that base layer is just as secure and private as we can possibly make it.
And often the attack against privacy coins is the age-old, it's for criminals and drug dealers, and the right defense comes back that, no, it isn't, you know, privacy is a right. But even myself, sometimes I thought, yeah, but come on, it is being used on the dark web. But actually, what was very interesting, I met last week with David Chaum, and in preparing for that, I read a quote of his where he said privacy is tied to human potential, an important aspect of democracy. And what I didn't realize is that actually some of the things that people want to do in life that will progress humans are probably things they don't want people looking at them doing. And I'd never crossed my mind that side of things. So why is privacy then so important to you?
Yeah, I mean, like, so from my perspective, I think it really comes down to, I think that we've got this weird situation that we've landed ourselves in where there are a bunch of institutions that have suddenly been forced to be law keepers and law enforcers. So if you go back 30 years to before we had traceable money, if somebody was suspected of a financial crime, then a law enforcement agency would have to go and demonstrate to a judge that this person was probably was suspicious, at least, you know, not necessarily guilty, but just something suspicious was happening here. And a judge would give them the right to go and the judge would be the person deciding whether or not that was viable. And if the claim was viable, if the suspicion was viable, then the law enforcement agency was given the permission to go and investigate that further. They were given the right and the tools. And then they could go do things like surveil the person. You know, they could do all sorts of active surveillance. They could also go to go and phone all of the banks and be like, does this person have a bank account? Yes, his social security number, whatever. And they could build up a really good understanding of this person. And the person couldn't really hide much because, you know, between active surveillance and being able to go and investigate their stuff at a banking level, you had a pretty powerful set of tools as a law enforcement officer. Now you fast forward to where we are now, and instead what happens is law enforcement agencies sit with their feet up and go, so the law's cool, hey? And banks are the ones going, and financial institutions are the ones going, oh, we need KYC AML. Oh my word, this deposit came in and it's above a certain threshold, and now we need to file a SAR report. And then, you know, oh my God, well, maybe this person's suspicious, and now the bank is saying to you, where did you get this money from? And you're going, well, you know, the thing is I got it from my laundry business. And they go, what type of laundry? And now the bank is sending people to inspect your business to see if it's legitimate. And the bank is basically the police.
It's really funny.
It's crazy. I don't know how we ended up there.
So it's quite funny you should say that. I just took my first advertisement on my podcast, and I'm part of the Let's Talk Bitcoin network, and they made their first payment to me, and the company it comes from into my bank is, I think, BTC Media or BTC Inc. I just put up a tweet yesterday. When I logged into my bank account yesterday, I was asked all my details of my employer and my income.
Yeah, that's the bank is now suddenly the FBI, you know what I mean? Like, what is... Why is it the bank's job to police your deposits? I mean, you know, there should be some suspicion of wrongdoing from the people that are actually able to evaluate that. The law enforcement agencies, there should be somebody who phoned in like an anonymous tip to say like, hey, we think Peter's getting money from drug deals. And then they go and investigate you. Not the person paying you had BTC in their name and so therefore.
Well, we're all guilty till proven innocent now.
Well, that's it, right? It's a complete about face. And it's the most shocking thing to me because I feel like the change has been very subtle. I feel like we're the frogs in the pot that have been boiled and we didn't realize that the heat was increasing. And now there is over the past, I would say probably the past 10 to 15 years, really, there's been an uprising. Of people that value privacy. They don't value privacy because they're weird. They're no offense to anyone who does this, but they're weird people who want to go hide in the woods and be off grid. And the government's tracking me with their satellites. You know, it's not just that. I mean, ordinary citizens who are going, I'm not comfortable with the amount of data that I'm dishing out to Facebook. And they're the ones that are protected against stuff like Cambridge Analytica. When the Cambridge Analytica thing happened, I went, well, they clearly don't have my details because I'm not on Facebook. And I haven't been on Facebook for well over a decade. So, you know, I'm fine. And I think there are a lot of people that are realizing that we've just become complacent in the amount of information we dish out. And so privacy tools are slowly becoming cool. And that's really where I hope we're going.
Yeah, so I'm quite interested in the Brave browser. Questions over the Bat token, but very interested in the Brave browser. And it feels like not enough people care about privacy, probably because they just don't realize what's going on. They're just living their lives, or they don't comprehend the amount of information being shared. Look, we work in tech. We know, right? But at the same time, it feels like there are enough people on the building side who understand, and we're potentially going to see a seismic shift in tools available for privacy.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think, I mean, I have the same concerns with Brave. I think the browser is amazing. I think Bat is the most useless thing on the planet, and no one's going and buying more Bat after they use their airdrop tokens. But I think more than that, I think we have seen a slow shift. Like Opera, for example, added a VPN to their browser, and became like a default. So, you know, you use Opera, you're using the VPN, and everything's great. And that was, I think, the first step in the right direction. And I actually know people who, you know, not so much in like the US and in Europe, but friends who live in the UAE who started using Opera because in the UAE you get a bunch of stuff that gets blocked. And obviously people in some Asian countries as well that started using it. So there's definitely been a shift in just small privacy enhancements. And VPNs, I think, are a great example of this because 10 years ago, if I said to someone, I'm using a VPN, well, they'd mostly go, what's that? but even if they did know what it was, they'd be like, oh, why? What are you afraid of? And nowadays, people are just like, oh, I use a VPN, you know, and they don't, some of them don't even know why. They just use a VPN because their friend told them it's a good idea. And some of them use a VPN because they once, you know, torrented a movie and got a letter, for, whatever, DCMA letter or whatever, DMCA, whatever it is. And so now they just use a VPN. They're not even torrenting anymore. They're using Netflix, but they're still using a VPN.
Do you think apathy is a result of ease of use? So, for example, when I was recently in San Francisco, you know, I'm looking for a restaurant, right? As soon as I start typing in best restaurant, it's coming up with in San Francisco. And there's a lot of things associated with Google where it knows or understands me that are quite useful.
Yeah, I actually have an interesting view in this. There's no tech company that's perfect, and they certainly all make missteps. But I find Apple's approach really interesting, especially when it's contrasted with Google. As an example, you know, in Apple stuff, it will suggest replies to messages, and it does facial recognition of your photos. And you know, I can be like, oh, look, I want to see all the photos of my wife, and it'll show me all the photos of my wife, and that's really powerful. The thing is that facial recognition is not done in iCloud. The message stuff where it reads your messages and suggests replies is not done in iCloud. It's all done on device, and it's purposely done on device as a privacy measure. If Apple had to go and do facial recognition on the cloud, it could be a massive, incredible source of revenue for them. They could do all sorts of stuff. In fact, they could be used by law enforcement to identify the phones that terrorists are using. Or identify terrorists in a crowd. They could do all sorts of stuff like that that's really good for humanity. And yet they've taken the strong pro-privacy stance where they're like, we will not analyze your photos in the cloud. Your device will analyze your photos, and it will do facial recognition. And they build specific – they actually build hardware that is specifically geared towards this. They're building like facial recognition ASICs for your phone so that it's able to do this faster. And I think that is – you know, for a tech company to take that stance is mind-blowing. And again, they're certainly not perfect. They certainly have made their mistakes. But just the general approach of, like, we're trying to help people stay private is good. And the fact that you can get all the facial recognition stuff, even with iCloud disabled, is, again, you know, just emphasis on the fact that the functionality does not require you to upload stuff to a central processor that can look at all your information, all your metadata for your photos, and make some determination on your behalf.
Next up, I talked to Ricardo about ideas for a privacy web stack, Tari, the new protocol he is working on with Naveen, and what's coming up for Monero. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsor. If you're holding onto Bitcoin and Ether and would like to put it to work without selling, then you might want to take a look at BlockFi. If you are bullish on crypto and don't have the cash you need to start a business, finance a home, pay down debt, or anything else, BlockFi can help. It's just a home equity line of credit. BlockFi gives cryptocurrency owners access to cash through the lowest cost crypto to dollar borrowing. With the largest crypto-backed lending footprint in the US, BlockFi offers regulatory compliant loans that can be delivered into your bank account in less than 90 minutes. They are the only cryptocurrency to USD lender to receive institutional investment, enabling them to provide the most affordable and trustworthy lending service within the ecosystem. And they have also created a special offer to listeners of my podcast. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, which is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for under $10,000. Or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000. And applying only takes 2 minutes. And have you envisaged any form of kind of idealized privacy tech stack for the internet? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, so it's one of the things that myself and my co-founder Tari, Naveen, him and I have spoken at length about a privacy tech stack and what would that look like. And obviously, you know, Monero is a key component to that. I think Tor is a part of that. Covery is a part of that. You know, there are a bunch of things that are a part of that. Even like comms protocols, you know, I'm a big fan of Wire, as a communications tool, more so than Signal because it doesn't require your phone number. And I think that there's a lot of stuff that's happening in that space that's really useful. You know, VPNs for when you need to stream Netflix, because streaming Netflix over Tor is just not really viable right now. Other stuff like, if you want to send an email, you know, are you using Google? I mean, I certainly am a whole bunch for a lot of our corporate stuff, and that's not great. But at least like, you know, for I've sort of siloed it out, and at least I like for emails that I know I need to keep private, I've got access to Tutanota and so on. And I think that there's so much scope for a privacy tech stack. And I think we're, you know, maybe, I don't know, we're maybe a couple of years away from just having something where people are able to go like, this is my tech stack, you know, everything runs through this. And maybe Cubes is the operating system that's going to drive that, because they're doing amazing work. But I think we're just like, we're just not there from a usability perspective. We're there from a tech perspective. You know, we can tie these tools together, but just from a usability perspective, things are still clunky. You know, I need to be able to understand as a user. I need to be able to silo things. I need to go, this browsing experience, I need to be fast through a VPN. This browsing experience, I need to be super private. So, you know, that making that distinction is difficult. And Brave, for example, is getting there with their Tor tabs and that sort of thing. But it's still chunky. It's still just not there yet. People are still struggling to understand the difference.
Well, you have to care and you have to understand the implications. For most people, they really just need to be able to go to Apple, buy a computer, come back. When they switch it on the first time, the browser says, would you like to activate private viewing? And this is why you should care. And the same with email. It almost needs to be inbuilt and taught to you as part of the process. And I guess that requires some kind of entrepreneurial spirit to make that happen.
Yeah, and I do think that, you know, at some point, like if anyone's going to make a move to really start tying some of these things together, it might be a company like Apple. You know, they're not perfect, but at least they have a privacy mindset. And I'm hopeful that look, they'll probably reinvent their own version of Tor and call it like Apple privacy networking or something. And you know, they'll give it a fancy name, and then they'll have a whole like pitch in one of their things, and then Johnny Ive will come on, and there'll be a whole video where he talks about when we were designing Apple private networking, you know, it'll be a whole video, and then you'll see like the glossy networking cables, and but I mean, if it's a privacy enhancement, great, I'm all for it.
But they're a $1 trillion business built on selling lumps of things, you know, lumpy things, computers, phones, yeah. Whereas Google and Facebook are built on selling data. So they have that advantage, and they can use it, I guess, as a competitive advantage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think like, it's one of the reasons why distributors complain about Apple taking a piece of the pie when they sell software on the App Store or you know sell content on iTunes. But at the end of the day, like you know, I'm happier for Apple to take a piece of the pie than for Apple going like we're not going to take a piece of the pie and instead we're going to harvest all your data. Charge me, bill me, no problem. I will pay rather than having my data harvested.
Okay, so moving on to another subject, you mentioned Tari and Naveen, your relationship there. I wasn't actually aware until recently. Can you tell me about the project?
Sure. So we started this thing called Tari Labs, and Tari Labs is I'm trying to think of the right word for it. It's almost like an incubator, I guess. It's an actual funded thing that exists in Oakland and Nashville in the States and in Johannesburg in South Africa. And we have people that we're hiring. We're hiring extremely bright people whose job is to work on various aspects of the crypto ecosystem. That includes Monero. It includes Lightning. And it includes the Tari protocol itself, which we're going to build along with the community. So we're not owners of the Tari protocol. We're just a lab that wants to build cool stuff. And one of the things we want to contribute to is Tari. And so sort of separately, myself, Dan, and Naveen are stewards of the Tari protocol. And I guess to some degree the lab is as well. And Tari, the protocol, is a decentralized assets protocol that will exist on top of Monero. So we're very excited about things that are natively digital assets. So things like loyalty points, in-game tokens, in-game assets, tickets, I guess to some degree security tokens and ICOs to a lesser degree. These are all things that are natively digital, and these are things that we'd like to see built on Tari. Maybe even digital rights management. I don't know. What we're not excited about are things that try and bridge the gap between the physical world and the digital world. I don't find that very feasible. So, you know, when people go like, oh, we're doing property in the blockchain and, you know, you must just trust that we haven't sold the property in the background and you're holding a token that is actually worthless. I find that very disinteresting, but I think that there's a lot of cool stuff that can be done for natively digital assets and natively digital systems, and that's really what we're trying to build.
So, excuse the comparison, but in some ways similar to Ethereum in that you can issue some form of token or an asset, but you're not going to have smart contracts, you're not going to have decentralized applications, it's purely an asset.
Yeah, I mean, I think there will be some scope for contracts of a sort. I mean, you'll be able to do escrow contracts and that thing, but it's not really going to be some Ethereum competitor. We're not trying to build like the next big smart contract waffle thing. We're not trying to build the internet of smart contracts. We're not trying to build blockchain 7.0. We're just trying to build an assets protocol that works.
Right, okay. And the benefit to issuing an asset on Monero over, say, Ethereum, would be the privacy option. I read that you will have adjustable, selectable privacy option per token.
Yes, that's one aspect that is definitely going to be better, is I think the fact that you will be able to scale the privacy of an asset from not private at all to extremely private. But I think also scalability, you know, I think that the Ethereum approach to every node needs to know all the state is not really useful or usable. And I think that there's a lot of stuff that can be done, which, you know, just needs to be done from the beginning. It needs to be part of the design that lends itself more towards scalability.
Well, I'm guessing if you think that, say, game tokens are a potential use case, you're going to need very fast transaction times, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about things like that, if you think about like what we've traditionally seen with ICOs, where they sell out, some of them sell out in 12 seconds, and this is assuming that securities token tokens regulation actually comes and clarifies what is feasible and what isn't. If you look at things like tickets, when there's a hot ticketing on sale for a Beyonce concert, and everyone's sitting refreshing the site trying to book tickets, these are all things that would strain on undue strain on a network like Ethereum, where we're just maniacally focused on assets, and we think that there's a lot that can be done there.
So how do you, so if you were to issue tickets via Tari, how would you not have the same problems with the strain on the network with lots of people trying to get tickets?
So one of the things that's inherent in the Tari, and again, the Tari design is still very early days. We haven't even like really started discussing that with the community. We've got some ideas. The community has some ideas. But one of the things that is inherent in an asset protocol design is the fact that you have a central issuer of the asset. So, you know, we're with smart contracts, they're all pretending to be decentralized. Assets not so. It's very silly to pretend to be decentralized when you are clearly the central person that's issuing the asset. It's like when Ripple say that they are more decentralized than Bitcoin, and everyone has a good giggle. The reality is there's a central person that issued it. And so it's the same. Yeah. You know, you've got a central issuer who is issuing the ICO, who's issued the security token, who's issued the ticket. And so the strain is on that single point. And we have a bunch of ideas about how we can, alleviate the strain, how we can decentralize to a small degree that strain. So instead of there being a single asset issuer who's responsible for all the infrastructure, they can pay to offload that infrastructure to 30 people. So it's almost like them spinning up 30 AWS slices to handle the ICO sale or ticket sale or whatever. And for a game designer as well, instead of them having to run their own infrastructure and have like hot AWS slices ready to go, they can just pay other people to spin those up during peak gaming times. It's almost like a natural sharding mechanism if it's designed correctly.
Right. Okay. And I guess you now have a lot of other examples of work that people have done or experiments people have tried to learn from.
Yeah, absolutely. In some ways, I think what we're trying to be is the spiritual successor to Counterparty, or the spiritual sister to Counterparty by building on the top of Monero. So there are a lot of lessons we've learned from what Counterparty have built. And Counterparty is about the only decentralized assets protocol that I would pay any attention to. And I think that there's certain decisions that they've taken early on, which I would have done differently, and which we are doing, which I hope we're going to do differently in Tari, definitely from a scalability perspective. And of course the privacy stuff as well. But just in general, I think that Counterparty has been a good, well-designed, project that was very early on as well. And so they've got all the hassles from falling into the thinking that we used to have, you know, in the early days where it was like, 2013, 2014, it was all about let's store all the data on a blockchain. And now in 2018, it's like, how can we store as little information on the blockchain as possible?
Right. Okay. Okay. And then therefore, so people will be able to issue an ICO on Tari, right? And it's, I guess it's a different world where we might see a flood of privacy-based ICOs.
Yeah, look, I mean, again, it's we don't.
I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
Yeah, we don't write the use cases, so we just create the functionality.
Yeah.
If people want to issue a token and they want to do so quasi legally, or if they want to do so as a fully legal whatever security token, the functionality will be there for them.
Is there any risk, therefore, if people are issuing privacy-based tokens, that it's open to scamming? And again, that's not your problem. Again, you're issuing the technology. But do you think there's almost going to be a public face to a token, but it could be private itself? Because otherwise, if it's a private issuer on a private token.
Absolutely. That is definitely like something that I've thought about at great length. And I think a good example of this are in-game tokens. You know, if you're playing World of Warcraft or whatever, or EVE Online, and you don't really want people to know how much you have and what ships you own and how much gold you own and whether you own the sword of whatever, these are all things that you want to keep private. And yet, the asset issuer, the original asset issuer, is a known entity. So privacy is not something that is mutually exclusive there. At the same time, if someone's going, we're going to build a whatever decentralized exchange, and please give us money, but we're not going to tell you who we are, that would make me very nervous to invest in that.
Right. Okay. So what kind of timescale are you looking at for this project? Because obviously it sounds super interesting.
So building protocols are hard. I think that practically speaking, we're talking about anything from 18 to 24 months for testnet. I think we've got a pretty good idea about like how quickly the community can work with Atari Labs guys to push stuff out. We're building it in Rust. That's like the only firm decision that we have taken. Building it in Rust is just us sort of forcing a forward thinking approach. Building it in that way is, I think, very important. Just being forward thinking and doing things in a way that in 5 or 10 years time, that code base is not looking really haggard and we're like, wow, we really should have chosen differently. Practically speaking, it really is not a quick process.
And how close to the project are you? Are you guiding it? Are you leading it? Is somebody else leading it?
Yeah. So I sit with the team, the Atari Labs guys, once a week. I spend 3 days with them. I'm always on the RSC channels and, in the Telegram group and so on. I'm helping guide the Atari Labs team, and I will, do my best to help guide the community and like help them avoid pitfalls that we had with the Monero, with Monero's early life. But I can't really force anything. I can't force the community to make a particular decision, but I can sort of just push them and nudge them along.
So your time then split between that. I guess you're scaling back on Monero and maintaining probably a level amount of time on professional trolling.
Yes. I'm trying not to reduce my professional trolling time. That's very dear to me. As the Monero Enterprise Alliance Chief Entertainment Officer, I've got to make sure I keep focused there. Especially because one day we might introduce Meat, the Monero Enterprise Alliance token. in all seriousness, yes, I've scaled back the work the amount of time that I spend on Monero, because Tari has an upstream benefit. We're working on parts of the Monero ecosystem. It brings a lot of resources to bear, on Monero. And that's one of the reasons why I've tried to stay focused on doing both.
And with Monero, so I also watched your Jimmy Song interview, and I tend to steer away from technical items because I'm not very technical. When I first bought Monero, you'll remember, so it was about $14, and I downloaded this It was like a little like text-based editor wallet.
Yeah.
And bear in mind, I'm not technical at all, so I didn't know what the hell I was doing. It's only recently I've managed to move upgrade to the GUI. I struggle on the tech, but I think it also, a lot of people struggle on the tech. You know, these things are quite complicated. But what things are coming up for Monero that people should care about? Are there any privacy holes in the entire Monero ecosystem that are being fixed? I've also read about Bulletproof and Mimblewimble. Could you give us an update on all these items?
Sure. So I think let's deal with the last one first. So Bulletproofs are live on testnet. They've been live on testnet since December. There have been a bunch of improvements that have been rolled out. There's been a bunch of audits that have been done that the community crowdfunded for. And Bulletproofs go live on mainnet in October. And that reduces Monero's transaction size phenomenally by like 90% almost. And that's great for on-chain scaling. It's a massive boost to on-chain scaling. It also opens the door to some privacy enhancements in future as well. Mimblewimble is a technology that we are trying to apply to Tari so that the Tari sidechain will be something that people can move in and out of, and they will find that quite easy to do as well. And they will benefit from those scalability enhancements, but they will be able to shift back into Monero quite trivially. So then you get the scale with the privacy on both sides. In terms of other ecosystem things that are really interesting that are happening right now, we've got hardware wallet support that's building out. So Ledger released their initial stuff. There are a bunch of improvements to the Ledger integration that are happening. And then Trezor are busy working on Model T support for Monero, so that's happening as well. Over and above the hardware stuff, we're also quite excited about things that are being improved from a usability perspective. So as an example, the My Monero has a mobile wallet, but they also have a desktop wallet. And it uses a lightweight protocol where you offload the scanning of your transactions to the central My Monero server. But one of the things that My Monero is busy building out is a open source version of that, so that you'll be able to run your own scanning node at home, and then your mobile wallet, desktop wallet, whatever, will just offload the scanning stuff to that. And we expect people will run volunteer clusters of these and all sorts of stuff like that. So it will make the lightweight wallet experience easier, more secure, and more private than it currently is.
Wow. And is the Monero marketing department getting ready to announce all this?
Of course. You know, with all our funding that we have, we're just getting ready to do TV shows. Obviously, you know, I'm excited about being on Jerry Springer and announcing stuff there.
How does the community organize itself?
So everything's very self-organizing. So if somebody wants to do something with Monero, then we typically say, sure, no problem, go ahead. I mean, why are you asking for permission? The logo is CCBY4 licensed. So, you know, you can use the logo to do whatever you want. You can make money from the logo. So you can create T-shirts and sell them and we can't stop you. So Creative Commons is very powerful there. All the Monero code is liberally licensed. It's BSD3 clause. And so if anyone pitches up and says they want to do something, we're just like, go ahead. And when I say we, I mean the community. And so everything's self-organizing. If somebody wants to do marketing, no problem at all. You just have to self-organize. You have to get a bunch of people together that also want to do marketing. And then you have to go to the community and try raise funds for the TV ads you want to do, the Super Bowl you want to sponsor, whatever it is.
It was quite interesting.
The NASCAR car.
I saw it yesterday. So I was preparing a presentation I've got to give today, and it's quite interestingly, in preparing for this interview, I saw your presentation at the Bitcoin conference, and so I've changed my originally it was why retail should care about Bitcoin, but now I've got and Monero, and I use this tool called Font Awesome for icons, and I noticed Monero is now within the Font Awesome list. Do you know that?
Yes. Yeah. So that was a bit of a surprise, but that's something that we're really grateful for.
It means you've made it.
Say again.
It means you've made it when you've made the Font Awesome.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. I mean, if you're in Font Awesome, then you must be important.
You must be awesome.
You know, I'm waiting for the fun, awesome, fluffy pony icon. You know, that's all I want in my life.
All right, well, listen, look, I'm going to wrap this up now. Thank you so much for this. I'd love to do it again sometime and hopefully in person. We keep passing each other in cities, but hopefully at some point we'll do it because it'll be good to catch up. But before we end, can you just tell people who you want to hear from on the various projects, how they should get in touch and how they can follow the projects?
Sure. So the best ways to engage with the project are obviously getmonero.org is the website. On Twitter, we're at Monero. And then on Freenode, on IRC, we have the hash Monero channel, which is always a good starting point. And then on Reddit, we have the r Monero subreddit. And those are really the main touch points. You can also follow me, I'm Fluffy Pony on Twitter, if you're into professional trolling, or professionally being trolled, whichever. And over and above that, like, as I said earlier, everything's self-assembling. There are no leaders. There are no, there are individual leaders for aspects of the project. And, you know, there certainly are people who are very prominent, and who follow the project very closely. But at the end of the day, you know, given the nature of the project, if you want to know more, there's the Monero Stack Exchange, which is great for more technical questions. And the Monero subreddit, which is good for, you know, sort of general discussion. There are a bunch of other subreddits for things like discussing mining or price talk or trading and that sort of thing. It's a great community because everyone retains a sense of skepticism. In fact, every Sunday we have a Skepticism Sunday thread on Reddit, which is good to post in. Come and talk about your concerns about Monero. Talk about an apathy to privacy and the things that you think will mean Monero never succeeds, and we discuss them.
Amazing. Well, listen, this has been great. I'm glad we finally got to do it, and hopefully we'll catch up again soon. Thanks, Ricardo.
Thanks so much.
Okay, what did you make of that? Did you enjoy that? How cool is Ricardo? He's so cool. I love him. I think he's brilliant. I love the Monero project. It was so interesting to talk to him about privacy and why it's important. And I've learned a bunch this week. I've learned a bunch of things I didn't realize are important with privacy. And I think Monero has a really important role to play in this space. I think Bitcoin is important, but there will be challenges in bringing privacy to Bitcoin, and some people have a need for privacy now, and Monero plays a role. So I fully support the project. I love it, and I'm so grateful for Ricardo coming on the show. Okay, so please do support the show, though. I mentioned in the intro, I've got a Patreon page. I won't go into all the detail now, but please do go and check that out. That's patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. If you want to support the show, there's some few options for you there. Please do go over to iTunes and leave me a review. These reviews really do help with the show listening on iTunes and help people find it. Please do follow me on social media. My handle is at whatbitcoindid. You'll find me everywhere. Twitter, Medium, Steam It, Instagram. So please do. And feel free to reach out to me. Please do check out my website. As I mentioned in the intro, I've got a new homepage and I've got a new resources section. Look, and if you've got any ideas for things I've missed on a resources page, do reach out to me. I'll be willing to add them. And then please share the show out with your friends and family. And let other people know where they can find it. Okay, so big thanks out to my engineer, Jason. Every week he gets me out of the, how do I say it? Gets me out of the proverbial shit because I always send him the podcast pretty late. So thank you, Jason. I've got his details in the show notes as well. If you've got any audio engineering needs, do reach out to him. And listen, I hope you all have a great week and I'll see you soon. Thanks.